නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස Last time we started discussing අලගද්දූපම සුත්ත which is another interesting sutta available in the Majjhima Nikaya and this discourse actually has several similes and again a kind of a strong instruction is included particularly for the monks but nowadays it's quite important for other lay people as well because the context is quite interesting and one occasion one venerable called Aritta started developing some sort of a wrong view a pernicious view where he is thinking that he understood the dhamma in a way that what Buddha has mentioned as obstructive for the spiritual life are not really obstructive so that is the sort of idea wrong view he start developing so basically this pernicious view is related to the karma, the sensual gratification, because the Buddha has mentioned that the sensual gratification is particularly has certain negative impact towards the spiritual life or spiritual endeavors. Now here, this venerable Aritta start having a wrong view, and he particularly seems developing and spreading that view and then certain monks understood that heard that and they went to him and tried to convince him and again particularly mentioned about how Buddha has explained the danger of the sensual gratification so last time actually we discussed in detail these 10 kinds of similes where Buddha has given in order to explain the defects, in order to explain the certain drawbacks in the sensual gratification. Various similes are there. So like Buddha has mentioned that the sensual gratification is somewhat similar to a skeleton where a dog is simply trying to allay hunger. But unfortunately he can't have anything from that because a skillful butcher has completely taken out all the available flesh in that particular bone. So likewise, various interesting similes are there. We already discussed these things last week. And likewise, so these venerables started trying to convince Venerable Aritta to neglect, to abandon his wrong view. But unfortunately, he was so fixed with his wrong view and so he denied to accept that so ultimately these venerables have to go to the Buddha and have to inform the same thing to the Buddha now the other bhikkhus were unable to convince him detach him from that wrong view pernicious view and therefore they decided to approach the Buddha and then inform that to the Buddha then Buddha summoned him Venerable Aritta And Buddha also questioned Venerable Aritta whether he is having this kind of wrong view. Then he accepted that. And then Buddha actually vehemently condemned him, vehemently criticized his wrong view. And again he is asking to whom that I have mentioned something like that. So with various similes, with various ways that I have mentioned you, the danger of this sensual gratification... So you are wrongly putting me in the wrong perception or you are wrongly accusing me. I have informed that everybody or these particularly for the monks and nuns that the sensual gratification has these dangers. So this is already mentioned. And why are you telling like that? So why are you trying to deny that? So likewise Buddha vehemently criticized Venerable Aritta. And then Venerable Aritta was very much can't speak and he simply kept his mouth shut, and again he is silent and very much without any response. So at that time, actually, Buddha again mentioned, "Misguided man, you will be recognized by your own pernicious view. I shall question the bhikkhus on this matter." Now Buddha now want to verify whether any other monks also have that wrong view. And on the other hand, by knowing that none of the other monks are having such wrong view, then Venerable Aritta will be isolated and he only will have that wrong view. So therefore, he has to admit that he is the only one has gone wrong. So therefore, Buddha addressed the other bhikkhus. "Bhikkhus, do you understand the Dhamma taught by me as this Bhikkhu Aritta, formerly of the vulture killers? Does when by this wrong grasp he misrepresents us, injures himself and stores up much demerit?" "No, Venerable Sir, for in many ways the Blessed One has stated how obstructive things are obstructions and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them." So likewise, the other monks are explaining that Aritta is wrong, and Buddha has explained in many ways how obstructive is the sensual gratification, and so they accepted what Buddha has mentioned. Then Buddha was happy about their answer, and again Buddha again explains the same thing using those 10 similes, the danger of the sensual gratification. And then very interesting statement Buddha made at the end of this episode, because that one can engage in sensual pleasures without sensual desires, without perceptions of sensual desire, without thoughts of sensual desire, that is impossible. So basically we can understand, if one is engaging with any kind of a sensual pleasure, we can further extend it to a sexual, say, pressure, that indicates his mind is already going through with lot of sensual desires and perceptions of sensual desires and thoughts of sensual desires. So that means his mind has to be first occupied with these different sensual desires and various perceptions, various signs, images of the sensuality. And he start fabricating that, he start thinking about that. Then only he is going and acting and try to gratify his senses. So therefore, if someone is telling that I am just enjoying sensual pleasures, I am enjoying, say, sexual pleasures, but I am just keeping my mind completely empty, I don't have any sensual desire, I don't have any sensual perception, so that is impossible. So that's a very strong statement that Buddha made. So that means one's mind has to be first corrupted, one's mind has to be deluded, one's mind has to be defiled before he start engaging with whatever the sensual pleasures. Now, as I mentioned last time, so this particular sutta is meant for monks, and therefore the lay people doesn't need to be frightened, thinking that all sorts of sensual pleasures are prohibited. Actually, for the lay people, Buddha has mentioned about the 5 precepts, and there again he talked about the 3rd precept, that is the Kame Sumichachara Veramani. That is where one is not engaged with any kind of wrong sexual relationship with another person's partner. So that means one is loyal to one's relationships, and trustworthy relationships are maintained. And again, there is no any kind of harmful kind of gratification. So that is the one imposed, or that is the one advocated for the lay people. But for the monks, Buddha has completely preached about the complete celibacy. So if one is committing that I am going to be a monk, one is committing that I am going to be a nun, so that means he is supposed to adhere to the complete celibacy. So after he becoming a monk, so if he is associating, say, a woman, a man, from a sensual point of view and try to gratify sensual desires, so that is not going to make him allowable in the monkhood, rather he has to be abandoned. So his monkhood has to be suspended. So the same thing has happened sometimes in the Vinaya Pitaka. Certain monks are having wrong relationships, and sometimes they have sexual intercourse. So then they simply lose their monkhood. So that precepts are so strong. So when we are thinking about the complete, the strong type of intimate relationship, a sexual relationship, that means he is no more a monk, no more a nun. So that means these things are quite strongly advocated, strongly preached for the monks and nuns, where they have promised, they are committed to maintain complete celibacy. Now after completing this part, now Buddha get into another area, explaining how one has to understand the Dhamma. Now we know that Buddha's teaching is explained in many different ways, and it has what we call as Navanga Shastru Sasana. That means 9 types of areas explaining the Dhamma, explaining the teaching of the Buddha. So these are called discourses, stanzas, expositions, verses, exclamations, sayings, birth stories, marvels, and answers to questions. Now these are the 9 areas typically where the complete Dhamma is categorized to. Discourses, that means various suttas are there. So as we already discussing the Alagaddupama Sutta, so likewise suttas are divided into various areas, various nikayas, sections, Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. So likewise many ways the suttas are categorized. So suttas are one area, and then stanzas. There are certain suttas again which only has verses, like certain suttas in the Sutta Nipata, say Karaniya Mitta Sutta, so only has the verses. So likewise verses are there to explain the Dhamma. And then expositions, there are kind of Vibhanga type of discourses where it is quite descriptive. Maybe the long discourses particularly available in the Digha Nikaya. So likewise certain descriptive information is also there, so that is also explaining the Dhamma. And then verses. So this is somewhat similar to the stanzas, and where some precise or concise way of representation of the Dhamma. And then exclamations, udana, where on certain occasions that when Buddha come across a situation, so he makes an exclamation, udana, kind of relating to this particular incident, he is making a kind of an utterance, exalted kind of utterance. And then sayings are there, like Dhammapada and all. So the sayings are there with respect to a particular incident, he may make a comment. And birth stories, Jataka stories, where he discuss what he went through during his past lives and the connection between those incidents, and taking some examples from those Jataka stories. So those are also another area of the Dhamma. Marvels. So this, can't remember. And answers to questions. This is the Vedalla, where certain discussions are there, like Mahavedalla, Chula Vedalla. So those kinds of suttas actually are represented explaining certain discussion happened between either with the Buddha and another monk, or another monk with another monk, another nun with a lay person, like in the Chula Vedalla Sutta. So likewise we can say, so various different kinds of Dhamma are explained in different categories. Now here Buddha now explained that certain monks, certain nuns, or whatever the lay people, so they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. They may be try to start or try to study those different teachings, but they are not carefully examining the meaning of the Dhamma. Not examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. Now, in order to understand the teaching, we need to little ponder about it, examine it, compare it, rationalize it. So likewise, many different ways that sometimes we have to contemplate. Then only one can understand what the Buddha meant there. Then only it is possible to get the true meaning. And sometimes if it is even difficult to understand, then we have to question another person. Maybe we can approach a monk, kind of a knowledgeable person, and we can look at or get an answer, get a kind of an opinion, explanation. Or else we have to refer some more suttas, more books, and try to understand the meaning. So likewise, one has to have that kind of an approach where one hopes to have a better understanding about the teaching, and one is using one's wisdom to understand it properly. And sometimes, interestingly, what we understood at the beginning may vary when we are trying to understand at another occasion. Say, today I read a particular sutta and I understood something, but maybe after a couple of weeks, if I am reading the same sutta, probably I may have a different understanding or a deeper understanding of the same sutta. So likewise, as we practice, as we continue our path, so the understanding that we are having with respect to a particular teaching is deepening. And that's why the discussions and the kind of presentations, etc., are quite relevant so that we can properly understand the Buddha's teaching. But unfortunately, certain people don't do that. What they do is they learn the Dhamma only for the sake of criticizing others and for winning in debates. Now, this is Buddha trying to explain sometimes why people are learning Dhamma. It is not for their own understanding, not to really having some spiritual knowledge to uplift their path. Rather, they also want to learn just to criticize another person, thinking that I am more knowledgeable than you. And if someone is telling a particular idea, then I can deny that, I can reject that, I can argue with that person. So having such kind of a motivation, if one is learning Dhamma, so that is what Buddha criticizing here. And they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learn the Dhamma. Now, since they have a wrong view, they have a wrong perception, wrong idea when they are studying Dhamma, so they can't actually get the proper meaning. They can't actually get the benefits from the Dhamma. Because they are not practicing it, they are not live according to the Dhamma. Rather, they are simply learning it just to criticize others and to win the debates. Those teachings being wrongly grasped by them conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. Why is that? Because of the wrong grasp of those teachings. Now, this is also interesting, and here Buddha is now giving the simile of the snake. Suppose a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils or its tail. So you can understand, if one is trying to catch a snake by the tail or its coil, then ultimately the snake will turn back and bite the man. So he will either die or he will go through a strong suffering. Now, Buddha is giving this simile of the snake for the wrong grasping of the Dhamma. So that means when we are learning Dhamma, we have to be quite honest. We have to have the proper mindset that we are learning Dhamma in order to, say, overcome suffering, to understand the teaching, to develop my practice. So likewise, there should be the proper motivation, rather than try to learn Dhamma just to criticize others, to win debates, to get into arguments, and to be considered that I also know Dhamma, so something like that. So therefore, when we are learning Dhamma, we have to have that proper attitude. So therefore, Buddha has criticized here the wrong way of grasp of the Dhamma. And on the other hand, Buddha again explained another person. He is having the proper motivation, proper attitude, where he is learning Buddha's teaching in order to develop his spiritual qualities. Maybe to be free from suffering, to attain Nibbana. So they are not learning to criticize others or to win debates. But they now are using their wisdom to investigate the Dhamma. They discuss the Dhamma. So likewise, those teachings being rightly grasped by them conduce to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Why is that? Because of the right grasp of those teachings. Now again, Buddha gave the same simile of the snake, but here the snake is caught properly. A man is seeing a large snake and caught it rightly with a cleft stick, and having done so, grasped it rightly by the neck. Now even the snake may turn back and try to coil, but nothing, no harm, because the man has grasped the snake from the neck. Similarly, Buddha mentioned, so here, if one is learning Dhamma with the proper attitude, so it will be quite useful. It will be really beneficial. But on the other hand, if they are learning Dhamma just to criticize others and to have debates with others, so that means that they are going to develop their conceit. They are going to harm themselves. Therefore, bhikkhus, when you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. And when you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then ask either me about it or those bhikkhus who are wise. Now here we can see how Buddha is so critical about teaching the proper Dhamma to the monks. He doesn't want any monk to have a wrong understanding about the teaching and any kind of misrepresentation of his teachings. And here Buddha mentioned, if any monk has any doubt about his teachings, please come and discuss with me. Please come and ask from me. Or you may go to another learned monk and you go and ask from that particular monk. So this actually has happened many occasions. That's why many suttas are there. Sometimes certain monks go and ask from another monk. For example, say if we consider Madhupindika Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. So Buddha make a very short statement, a kind of a brief statement, and he went to his kuti. But the other monks didn't understand that. So what they didn't was, rather than wrongly grasping it, so they went to Venerable Mahakachana, who is a well-known arahant for his exceptional capability for explaining Dhamma in detail. So they approached Venerable Mahakachana, and then they invited Venerable Mahakachana to explain it. So then Venerable Mahakachana has given a very interesting explanation, and after hearing that, again they came to the Buddha and explained what they heard, and Buddha was quite happy about it. So likewise, there are many occasions how monks, when they didn't understand Buddha's teaching, they went to certain arahants, certain knowledgeable monks, and they asked what's the meaning. And on some other occasions, certain lay people, when they didn't understand certain teaching, so they go to a monk and ask, as we discussed already about in the Haliddhikani Sutta. So Haliddhikani is a householder. He didn't understand the meaning of a particular verse available in the Magandhya Panya in the Sutta Nipata. So he approached the same monk, that is the Venerable Mahakachana, and he is asking a better explanation from Venerable Mahakachana. And sometimes even certain lay people, So if they are quite knowledgeable and they are well known for their exceptional skills, sometimes even monks go and, or rather when that layperson come to a particular monk, that monk probably ask the question from that particular person. So very interesting. That is one example is Venerable, so this Chitta, the household Chitta, who is a very well known noble person. And sometimes certain monks have asked questions from him and he is giving a very interesting explanation. So likewise, so if we don't understand the teaching, if we don't understand a meaning, so it is always necessary to ask from others rather than thinking that we know, rather than taking a wrong grasp, rather than taking a wrong interpretation of the Dhamma. So therefore here, Buddha is very critical about maintaining the consistency, maintaining the accuracy of his teaching. And we can say during the Buddha's time, there are no any sort of mechanisms other than communicating face to face, so have a kind of a direct interaction with others. So through the hearing only, mainly, they have maintained the teaching. Only later, after the Buddha's passing away, several centuries ago, only the teaching was put into a book, to the scriptures. But till that, monks are carefully remembering the teaching and they are discussing the teaching. And it's a very difficult task in a way, because sometimes remembering the teaching perfectly, correctly, is not easy. And if we miss a particular word, a syllable, then it can even give a wrong meaning. So that's why, as a group, sometimes monks are studying it, reciting it, and discussing it, so that they are maintaining the accuracy of the teaching. So therefore, we actually have to be thankful to those monks who have retained the teaching, who have remembered the teaching, who have protected the teaching. And when there are many people are available knowing the same Dhamma, so they can go through a kind of a council, they can go through a discussion, and they again and again can verify their understanding and their accuracy about the teaching. So that also has happened on certain occasions. They go through certain Sanghayana councils where they want to gather, say, many arahants, maybe 500 arahants, so after the Buddha's passing away. So they gathered and then they want to properly preserve Dhamma. So such kind of incidents have happened. So we can say, so they want to maintain the accuracy of the teaching, so they are very critical about it. So therefore, I mean, we can't have any kind of a very lapsed type of attitude with regard to Dhamma, because if we wrongly grasp it and if we are interpreting it wrongly, so that is a complete misguidance, misleading of oneself and the others. So that's why here we can say Buddha giving a strong advice to the monks. Therefore, because when you understand the meaning of my statement, remember it accordingly. And when you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then ask either me about it or those bhikkhus who are wise. So therefore, that is a kind of a strong advice Buddha has given. Now, with respect to Dhamma, he is giving another interesting simile. So that is the simile of a raft. Because I shall show you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Now here we can say, even though Dhamma has to be precisely understood, Dhamma has to be properly learned, and if there are any doubts, we have to question another person, consult another person, and we have to have the proper motivation, correct attitude when we are learning it. Still, Buddha gave a very interesting simile here, how Dhamma has to be handled. Because suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. Now, this is a very interesting simile, where one man is approaching a particular area and he found that, assume that that area is flooded or a strong reservoir, large reservoir is there, and he find his side is quite dangerous and fearful, and he definitely have to cross the river, definitely has to cross that water. And he is looking around and he couldn't find a boat, was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the other shore. Now what he is thinking? Then he thought, there is this great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear. But there is no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches and leaves and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Now you can see how he is thinking. So there is no boat, there is no ship, there is no bridge. Now he has to do something by himself. And now he is preparing a raft using the available things. Grass, twigs, branches, leaves. So those are the available things. And using that he is making a raft. Just by having a raft also not enough. Now using the raft, now he is making an effort with his hands, feet. He is having a lot of effort, and through that he is crossing the bridge, crossing the river, crossing the water, and now he is approaching the far shore. Now after done that, now an interesting way Buddha give here. Suppose once that particular man has gone to the far shore, so he is now thinking, this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now Buddha is giving a very interesting simile here. Now if that man think, so this raft is useful, because of that I was able to cross the shore, so let me carry it on my head or on my shoulder. So now Buddha is asking from other monks whether he is doing the correct thing. And the other monks are answering, no, no, Venerable Sir. And then on the other side, Buddha mentioned another person. If he also crossed the shore and he used the raft, and he is thinking, this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, because it is by so doing that that man would be doing what should be done with that raft. So I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Now, here the idea is the Dhamma, the teaching the Buddha has taught, has to be properly learned, has to be verified, has to be properly pondered. Using wisdom, one has to analyze it, properly understand it. And if can't understand either, still, you may have to go to another person and question him and try to understand it. Go to a discussion and try to understand it. So likewise, the proper Dhamma has to be understood, and then it has to be lived, it has to be practiced. And after practiced, suppose that you come to a certain realization. So after the realization, if one is holding it, carrying it, so that is also not the purpose, rather Buddha mentioned here. So this Dhamma is for crossing over, not for holding or grasping. And sometimes certain suttas explain how even Dhamma-related thoughts can hinder one's path. So there is another sutta, I think we already discussed that, Pansudhovaka Sutta. So there Buddha explained various levels of thoughts. At the very early level, the defilements are considered as gross kind of defilements. That is where the bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, mental misconduct. So that is considered as the raw or gross kind of defilements. And then the middle kind of defilements are the wrong thoughts, sensual desires, ill will, and the harmful thoughts. And then next, another subtle kind of defilements. So they are called sukuma vitakka. Like you are having certain thoughts with respect to gains, fame, etc. And maybe thoughts related to the country, the politics, about your parents, about your children, your friends. So likewise, certain subtle thoughts are there. Even that has to be abandoned. Interestingly, after all these subtle defilements are abandoned, now Buddha mentioned the mind can occupy with dhamma vitakka. Dhamma vitakka vasissanti. So certain dhamma related thoughts may be again and again coming to the mind. So mind can be occupied with that. So here it is very much like we are using a certain medicine to cure ourselves. And there may be certain side effects of the medicine, and even that side effect has to be abandoned. It also has to be cured. So similarly, the very same dhamma, the teaching that we have used to practice, to properly abandon various defilements. So there may be certain parts of dhamma again and again come into the mind and try to occupy the mind. So one has to be clever enough even to remove those thoughts, maybe dhamma-related thoughts, and keep the mind quiet, having the mind completely freed, having the mind completely non-grasping. Maybe time to time, at least, having the mind completely silent, maintaining a stillness of the mind. So there we can understand, so even dhamma-related thoughts have to be abandoned at one point. But again, we need to understand its utility value. Now, there are certain occasions that we purposely need to reflect about the Dhamma. That is where the Dhamma Anusati. Again and again thinking the good qualities of the Dhamma. So that is also required because it depends on where we are in our practice. So Dhamma is the Buddha's teaching and it is quite helpful. It is inspiring and giving us the proper direction. So remembering it, reciting it, pondering about it is very, very useful. So at that occasion, we actually have to do that. We have to do the Dhamma Anusati. We have to understand the teaching. We have to reflect about the teaching again and again. Even we can say the occupying the mind with the Dhamma. So by that occupation, all the defilements can be abandoned. All the doubts can be abandoned. All different, say, perplexities available in the mind can be abandoned because Dhamma is such a medicine. But when you are able to further and further practice and come to a level where you are capable of maintaining the mind free from any defilement, free from any kind of a grasping, at that time if you are trying to occupy the mind with Dhamma, so that is also not going to work. Rather, at that time you have to simply abandon the Dhamma even. So here, very interesting ways that we actually can analyze. Some people misunderstand this situation and they might think that they have to hold the Dhamma strongly, they have to grasp the Dhamma strongly, and they have to remember Dhamma strongly. So they start remembering the whole scriptures, occupying their mind with the Dhamma, again and again reciting that. But sometimes they are not living according to that Dhamma. They simply want to preserve Dhamma, but they are not critical about living according to Dhamma or to practice the Dhamma or to internalize the meaning of the Dhamma. So that is also, we can say, kind of a wrong grasping, wrong kind of an attitude. On the other hand, sometimes people thinking that Dhamma is even have to be abandoned, so then why should I learn the Dhamma? What's the purpose of learning Dhamma? Because anyway I have to abandon that. That is also a wrong thing, because that is very much like you are kind of, say, jettisoning the boat before even you cross to the other shore. So you need to first learn the Dhamma, understand it properly and maintain the proper attitude and make use of it. Then only you have to abandon the Dhamma. So therefore, if one is thinking, okay, I don't need to learn the Dhamma, that is also wrong kind of a grasp. And sometimes, on the other hand, when we are strongly grasping Dhamma and if we are thinking, okay, I inherit the Dhamma. So I am the possessor of the Dhamma. So that also can give a wrong interpretation and can improve one's ego, and one can easily get into arguments with others because you think, okay, you are the inheritance to the Dhamma. You are the guardian of the Dhamma. That is also another way of wrong grasp, because Dhamma is there for a purpose. So that's what Buddha here explained very carefully. So, because when you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even the teachings. How much more so things contrary to the teachings? So that's another statement that Buddha mentioned. So even the Buddha's teaching at the ultimate level has to be abandoned, then how about the other mundane type of things? Definitely you have to abandon that. There's no argument about it. So here very, very, very strong and very interesting similes are coupled here. So one thing is the proper grasp of Dhamma, indicating with the simile of a snake. And the other thing is how one is using the Dhamma and ultimately even abandon that, giving the simile through the raft. So this is a different ways of looking at it, or different perspectives what we have to take with respect to the meaning, with respect to the opportunity, with respect to the context. And these two similes are very, very interesting and very, very important, and when we are learning the Dhamma. So with that, actually, I can wind up today's sutta discussion, and I now like to open the session for questions. Okay.
Are there questions on your side, Bhante?
Yes, there is one question from our side. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, Bhante, I've heard that in the Tibetan tradition that before they even meditate, they study the Dhamma for years and years. Have you heard this?
Yeah. Even in Sri Lanka, I mean, sometimes they start learning it in detail and reciting it, memorizing it. In many traditions, it is there. And even in the Burma, Myanmar, so they study it and they recite it. That is also there. Now, in one sense, it is useful, because if we start practicing immediately and assume that they become an arahant, arahant may not have such a desire to protect, such a desire to maybe to grasp, to recite Dhamma, because he has taken the advantage. He has taken the benefit of the Dhamma. If they are protecting it, then it is called Dhamma Bhandagarika, where they are protecting it for the purpose of the others, for the benefit of the others, because their task is well done. So they already has taken the advantage of the Dhamma. So they are now, if they are want to further study it or further remember it, that is not for their own benefit, but for the benefit of the others, because they may want to teach it properly, they want to deliver the message properly. So therefore, it's a kind of a treasurer to the Dhamma. And on the other hand, as you said, sometimes what happens is if anyone assume that they are reading, learning Dhamma for long, long time, but if they are not having the proper meaning, so they may not do any kind of a practical living according to the Dhamma. Because simply taking the surface value, think it, simply taking the book value, doesn't mean that they know the real meaning, because Buddha's teaching always stay, okay, monks, there are trees, there are tree roots, then go and meditate. Go and practice. And on the other hand, if you consider the Vinaya, the book of the discipline, so there are, Buddha mentioned how you have to carefully protect the seal. So if one is learning Dhamma, so that meaning has to be absorbed, so that meaning has to be well understood, then they have to live according to that. So that is why when learning Dhamma, they can't simply abandon the sila, neglect the sila, and simply learn the Dhamma. Because sila is one part of the Dhamma, I mean, one area emphasized in the Dhamma. So if one is properly learning Dhamma, that means he may become more and more, say, spiritual, more and more moral, and he try to be more careful of what he is doing, etc. And not only that, and suppose they are studying the suttas. So the suttas may tell, okay, how to meditate, how to recognize defilements, how to abandon defilements, etc., etc. Now that means he has to now practice that as well. So therefore, so we can't say mere learning is the correct approach, but it has to be coupled with some amount of practice, then only it may be kind of a proper grasp. But unfortunately, sometimes today, so they are learning it just to earn a degree, to earn a kind of a title. So that is also something that we can say to some extent strong grasp, but we can't completely think that they are learning it to criticize another person or to win the debates. But as you said, just to learn it, just to understand, just to gather some knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But using it practically and including it to one's practice and getting the benefit or the guidance from the Dhamma is the true purpose, in a way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Asaray Swaminans, I just wanted to point out that you were talking about the right understanding of the Dhamma and, you know, understanding it correctly. And you're just talking about sila, you know. I think that's like one of the main problems of like a lot of you could say temples and monasteries nowadays. It's like even at meditation monasteries, like they're not always with like good teachers. They're not always like really serious about sila or vinaya or anything like that. And so you know, you can still see like incorrect kind of dhamma talk, you know. Like let's say like there's a monk who's like living at a monastery and he teaches meditation, and there are, you know, good monks who are good meditation teachers out there, but you know, you'll still see like some of them are, you could say perhaps even most of them, like not being so serious on the sila side. And so you still see that like incorrect kind of dhamma being promoted more or less in that sense. So I think that that's like one of the major issues that you know, you see in nowadays, is the correct understanding of the Dhamma not being properly understood by a lot of people. You know, where they're like missing the sila, like also in like the West, you know, like in like the US, you know, there is like I think like historically, or you know, a lot of the, I think the Dhamma that got initially spread to the West, a lot of it was like, at least in recent times, was like lay people spreading it. So the Sangha, the monastics were not, you know, now there are more monks in the U.S., like, you know, people being monks and teaching. But like in recent times, like with the spread of the Dhamma to the West, you know, Buddhist meditation to the West, you know, it's been a lot of like lay people spreading it. And so you see like that wrong, you see some wrong, you know, interpretations being taught. And so, yeah, you know, I think that that's, you know, the emphasis being on meditation, like, you know, like I think what's a lot of Westerners are interested in meditation, but they're not so interested in religion, quote unquote, which, you know, sila being quote unquote religion, these robes being like religion, you know, rules, you know, religion.
Correct.
But they just want to do the meditation, but they don't understand that the sila is very important for the restraint,
correct,
for the calming of the mind.
Yeah, very correct. So actually, on the other hand, we can say now in certain suttas, if one is starting from the meditation,
mm-hmm.
so if that is proper meditation, so Buddha mentioned, so you are absorbing the morality part into it.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose an immoral person starts meditating.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. I mean, he can start, no problem. Or suppose it's a Western person and he come to a monastery and he start practicing, but he assume that he is not good in his moral conduct.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, Buddha mentioned, if he's developing mindfulness and clear comprehension, one important result of that practice is the hiriyottapa. That means the moral shame and moral dread.
Mm-hmm.
So one result of developed mindfulness and clear comprehension is moral dread and moral fear. Sorry, moral shame. So that means he is now having kind of a shame to do wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
And he is fearful to do wrong things. And as a result of that, then Buddha mentioned he become more ethical, he is more concerned about his conduct, and he is getting to the properly bodily conduct, proper verbal conduct and proper mental conduct. So that means if one starts with meditation and if that is the correct meditation, slowly he has to abandon all the wrongdoings, all the wrong misbehaviors, and he has to be truly a person who is slowly become even moral person.
Mm-hmm.
Because these things are very much like connected together, and that is where now when we are considering the Noble Eightfold Path, Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So Sila is one part of it. Samadhi, the concentration or collectedness of the mind, is one part of it. And the wisdom, Panya, is another part of it. And we can't actually separate them as two, three pieces.
Mm-hmm.
They are well interconnected. And they are having their different interrelationships.
Mm-hmm.
One is supporting another. So likewise, say the morality supports the concentration, concentration supports the wisdom supports the morality, morality supports wisdom. So likewise, there are very interesting relationships among them. So therefore, if one is properly getting to the path, suppose that one is becoming a stream winner. So that means he well understood these three trainings, Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So that means he now only he get into the proper training, he start restraining himself. That is why he is called a Sotapanna. So you can say, therefore, even if waste, if someone is starting from the meditation, doesn't matter, but he slowly may abandon his wrongdoings, and he has to slowly come to the teaching, come to the Noble Eightfold Path, then only we can say he actually has practiced the proper meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I say one thing related, Bhante? I listened to a class that Bhikkhu Bodhi gave on this sutta, and he mentioned that the bhikkhu who made the mistake or make a mistaken view in this sutta may have got his misguided view, because at the time there were householders that were disciples of the Buddha that were stream enterers and mantra turners, who hadn't given up sensuality. They were, you know, married and had children, and so that monk could actually see, you know, and say, well, if they can do it,
Yeah.
Have you heard this as well?
No, actually, the thing is, that's where, I mean, sometimes even Mahasi Sayadaw, he give this kind of an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
So in the first book of the Mahasi,
mm-hmm.
So there he argues, now for the lay people, yes, it is the five precepts.
Mm-hmm.
But for the monks, either it is 10 precepts of the Samaneras and the Patimokkha rules for the fully ordained monks. Now the point is, if one is maintaining very careful attention to one's sila, one has to be very mindful. One has to be careful about what one's thinking. Because ultimately thoughts are going to be the actions. Your mind state is going to be implemented as actions. So if one is practicing properly and careful about one's sila, so having many precepts at the beginning seems like a burden. But later when one is slowly capable of doing that, so it become a kind of a highway to the, say, upliftment in one's good qualities. But as you said, probably the Venerable Arhatta might have seen that the lay people also have attained stream entry and all these other attainments being lay people. But it doesn't mean that all everybody has the same caliber. Say, if there are 1,000 lay people, that doesn't mean that everybody who are practicing have the same results. So it depends. Actually, there are maybe lay people who have exceptional qualities. Like we already discussed about the chitta, the householder chitta. He has exceptional qualities, and even monks have consulted him. And on the other hand, certain occasions, say monks are preaching the Dhamma to the lay people, and they simply come and ask, Pante, I mean, we are simply lay people, and we are simply, say, protecting our wives, children, and we have a lot of other things. So we don't have time to practice as you all. So please give us some teaching which is helpful. So something like that. So they admit. So that their occupancy, their difficulty in practice. So they can't fully dedicate themselves for the practice. So therefore, if one is committing as a monk, so that means a different story, where he is now abandoning all the lay activities, relationships, sensual desire, I mean the gratification type of things, and he is now committing to become a celibate person. So that, I mean, maintaining celibacy is a strong motivation for one's practice. At the beginning, if it appears like difficult, but the sensual urge, the sexual urge that is being slowly abandoned because of the celibate life is now diverted as a kind of a spiritual, say, upliftment, and you become more stronger, you become more kind of capable, and you become kind of confident that I can do it, I deserve it. So likewise, I mean, therefore the sexual relationships and these kind of activities has a significant impact on one's mind. So that's why Buddha mentioned, and even in the same sutta, that thinking, if one is telling, okay, I am having so if I take that part again, so here very interesting statement, say at the end, that one can engage in sensual pleasures without sensual desires, without perceptions of sensual desire, without thoughts of sensual desire. This is impossible. So that means if one is going towards upper levels of the spiritual life, so that means he has to be so careful about what he is thinking. So the thoughts about the perceptions, about the, say, the desires. So that means if he is going towards, say, for example, a non-returner level, so he has to completely abandon the sensual desires, no?
Yes.
So how one can engage with kind of a sensual relationship, say, gratification of senses, and then become a non-returner? Impossible. So simple as that. So therefore, I mean, it's two sides. So we need to understand, okay, if I am a lay person, okay, I can respect the five precepts, but I have to practice to the best of my ability. And definitely the other levels are available, attainments are available. On the other hand, if one is a monk, and one has to understand, okay, I have given up the sensual gratification, or I have now committed to live a celibate life, and I have to try to get the advantage of that life. So through that celibacy, what I am preserving, what I am sort of promoting, so how the spiritual qualities can be uplifted through the celibate life. So those advantages that if a monk is properly understanding and properly making use of, then it may be a fast track for the attainment. So that's why Buddha mentioned, so why people become monks or nuns, because they understood, okay, the lay life is filled with so many commitments, so many attachments, and a lot of occupants, and all these things. It's a kind of a burden. So difficult to quickly go to the path, I mean, go to the practice. But on the other hand, if properly lived the monk's life, yes, it is a very simpler way of doing, and less responsibilities, and one can spend a fair amount of time in meditation. So likewise, there are many benefits.
I wasn't trying to say that, well, maybe he was right.
Yeah, definitely,
but
I understand.
But more that, you know, that lay people could,
correct,
you know, go to once returner and,
yeah,
you know, still be, you know, very spiritual in their life, but still having sensual desires, sensual pleasure.
Correct. Yeah.
And I think I quickly wanted to say, I think in like countries where the Dhamma spreads too, you see this with like the different kinds of Buddhism that have come out, like Tibetan, Mahayana, Western, Eastern, all this stuff. I think a lot of cultural interpretations get thrown on the teachings. So you see that in the U.S. and other Western countries. You'd see that here, I'm sure, in Sri Lanka. You'd see that in like Burma. You'd see that in like Thailand, where, you know, you get these cultural kind of interpretations. So it's good that we have the suttas.
Original teachings. Yes. So actually, that is also true. That I mean, as the Dhamma spreading and people start living, there are various other influences coming to the picture, the cultural influences, political influences, and all these different things. So then we can't get the essence. Sometimes we get the wrong interpretation because it is kind of a blend of many things, a mixture of many things. Yeah. Okay, we can go to your side now, Jennifer.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Bande. I'd like to invite Malinka for the next question.
Bande, can you hear me?
Yes.
I just heard Lokapamudro say something quite interesting the other day. He mentioned correct view is no view, but he left it at that. He didn't go into that.
Yes.
Did he mean neither perception or non-perception? Can you go into that?
Rather than perception, say no grasping. Now, thing is, when you are considering the Kacchayana Gotta Sutta. So the Buddha very interestingly explained about this. So the actually, first of all, we need to understand two sides of the correct view. The first side is mundane type of correct view, and then the supramundane type of correct view. So the mundane type of correct view is actually still we believe in karma, and we trust the karma, and we become a good person, we become more moral, and those, that kind of understanding is required at the mundane type of correct view, what we call as the kammasakata sammaditti. So you become a more moral, responsible person. Then when you are shifting towards the supramundane level, so that is where it is called Arya Anasava Lokuttara Magganga. So that is the qualities represented in the supramundane type of sammaditti. So that is what referred in the Kacchayana Gotta Sutta. So there the meaning is, so you can't grasp anything at that level. So mind has to be completely liberated, completely abandoned, the none of the grasping should be available, and no any particular view that you even can grasp. You can't have any fixations, you can't have any standpoints. So then actually the mind is fully liberated, and as Buddha here also mentioned, you can't even grasp a Dhamma. So mind is fully liberated. Mind doesn't grasp anything, doesn't hold anything, and there are no mental standpoints. So therefore, we can't go for a fight with respect to the correct view. So the correct view is there, so there is nothing to grasp, and you are not going to any debates, any arguments. So that is the correct view in that sense. And you don't have any kind of an ego. So the all ego attributions, all self identifications, so everything is abandoned. So you are not promoting any self view. So therefore it's a completely kind of a radical path. Where nothing is grasped, nothing is held upon, and you can't even have a fixed view. It doesn't mean you become a kind of a malicious person or immoral person or dishonest person, rather no grasping at all. The grasping happens because of the delusion. Grasping happens because of avijja. Grasping happens because of not understanding. But on the other hand, when one is understanding further and further, when one's understanding is deepening, so it's become abandoning, letting go. So mind become more and more free, unattached, unassociated. So that is where Buddha explained about the sammaditti in the supramundane level. And there he further explained, okay, whatever arising is the suffering is arising. Whatever passing away is just the suffering is passing away. So now this person who is with proper understanding, proper right view, he knows that. So therefore he is not grasping anything. You can refer Kacchanagotta Sutta, very, very interesting sutta.
Thanks for that, Pandit.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? You can also send them via chat. Nalinka, you have another follow-up question? Okay.
So we'll do that by mistake. No.
Okay. Sure.
I don't think there's anything further on my end here, Bente.
Okay, fine. We have another one. Yeah, go ahead.
It's basically a comment, but you're probably saying this on that last question, but Bhikkhu Bodhi mentioned that when the monk goes to arahant or to advancement and he's letting go of views, he's not holding on even to the Dhamma or to attainments or anything. It's more that he's embodying the Dhamma.
Embodying the Dhamma. Point. Excellent. Yeah, very, very correct. Yeah, very, very correct. So that's why, I mean, when we are talking of an Arahant, so he is actually having the 10 factors. Samma Vimutti and Samma Jnana are two additional factors he is embodying. So he has the understanding, the knowledge, proper knowledge. As a result of that, his mind is freed. Samma Vimutti and Samma Jnana. So they are very much coupled. So the proper understanding, that means helpful to release, helpful to abandon, helpful for the freedom. So as a result of that, his mind is freed. That means he's embodying the understanding. His mind is completely liberated because of that. It's a very much a kind of coupled together. Very interesting. So it doesn't mean that he become a fool. Rather, his mind is liberated because he has the thorough understanding. And as you said, he has become Dhamma, very much like.
It's good if he understands the Dhamma taught by the Buddha.
Definitely.
Because then he understands it intellectually as well.
Not mere intellectual, but I mean the experience. Practice through his own experience, he understood that he is now embodying the Dhamma and he has become the Dhamma like. So that's why sometimes Buddha talking like, say, Venerable Sariputta, for example, he is born of Dhamma, Dhamma Ja, something like that, sometimes mentioned. So he's not a person anymore. He's not a kind of a typical human being anymore. So that's why sometimes for the arahants it is mentioned that he has gone beyond the normal notions, normal conventions of the human realm. So I mean, we have the typical mundane conventional terminologies talking this and that, but an arahant on the other hand completely penetrated that, completely has gone beyond that. Very interesting.
His mind isn't going there at all.
Yeah, maybe he is not making a self, he is not making I, myself, etc. And he know the conventions are merely conventions. He may even use them, no harm. But he know that it is mere convention and nothing is grasped in that sense. Yeah. Actually, I don't know whether we have discussed that Kacchanagotta Sutta. Jennifer, can you remember, did we discuss Kacchanagotta Sutta?
check, Bante. I'm
yeah.
not sure.
Okay, we'll see. If it is not, then probably we can discuss that as well. I mean, it's a very, very interesting sutta, discussing different aspects of the samadhiti.
Bante, I also wanted to point out something. You were talking about the simile of the raft.
Mm.
And that's a very interesting simile, because
exactly.
Buddha is talking about, he's talking about like how people, you know, study the Dhamma for arguing and debating, and I definitely, you know, have seen that before with like people, you know, they'll like know about the Dhamma and they'll get into a debate, or they'll like have some like online forum about the Dhamma and they'll be like sharing their views, like
right.
you know, this
yeah.
And so yeah, you know, you see even like with Dhamma practitioners, you know, like this grasping to the Dhamma, like, you know, even if you have like
actually,
the right view and right understanding of the Dhamma, you can like turn it into a weapon, more or less, where you can start like putting down others.
Exactly.
And like, oh, you're not following this part of the teaching correctly. You're not following, like, even if you are following the teachings correctly, it's like you don't need to like get down other people's throats about it.
Definitely.
It's like, yeah, you're just causing yourself dukkha.
Exactly.
That
so that's why, I mean, so that's why Buddha very beautifully mentioned in many suttas, I mean, the knowledge should not be for your showing off or to have conceit and to sort of look down the others.
Mm-hmm.
Then, I mean, if one is doing so, that means he has taken the Dhamma from the wrong end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from the tail of the snake. But on the other hand, if one is understanding the Dhamma and live according to the Dhamma, and definitely he may not go for the arguments with others. And the others are open to come and discuss in a more kind of a cordial way as a proper discussion. Not for any kind of an argument or kind of a debate or something like that. But a kind of an honest discussion point of view. Okay, since there are no more questions, then we'll wind up the session. So all the merits that we have accumulated today through the discussion and the listening to the Dhamma, we share with all the celestial beings and with all the past relatives and whoever in need of merits. And we wish these merits help us also to attain path, fruition, Nibbana. And while keeping these good wishes in our mind, let's recite the traditional verses. Ittavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam. Sambe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ittavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam. Sambe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ittavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam. Sambe satta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Akasatta ca bhummatta deva naga mahiddhika. Punyantang anumoditva chiram rakkantu sasanam. Akasattha ca bhummatta deva naga mahiddhika. Punyantang anumoditva chiram rakkantu desanam. Akasattha ca bhummatta deva naga mahiddhika. Punyantang anumoditva chiram rakkantu mamparam. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.